BEC fraud continues to be one of the most popular frauds targeting accounts payable. Learn how to protect yourself and your company from this leading industry expert and former FBI agent.
Welcome to the AP Now podcast, the podcast that covers trends, insights, and emerging issues impacting every accounts payable function.
Hi, guys. Welcome. I'm Mary Schaefer, founder of AP Now, the place where you go for all the latest business intelligence you need if you work and manage or have responsibility for the accounts payable function. Today, we're joined by retired FBI agent Vic Hartman to talk about that ongoing scourge of business email compromise fraud, or what we sometimes call BEC fraud. Hi, Vic. Perhaps you could start off by explaining exactly what BEC fraud is for the few people in our audience who may not know what it is.
Well, it's really grown in popularity, unfortunately, and there's a lot of variations. But the general idea is it's using an email by the fraudster to a victim company to gain funds or sensitive data. It's just a deceptive email that causes the victim to forego or give up their money, usually through a wire transfer, to forego funds or sensitive data.
So, Vic, I should tell you that the two types of BEC fraud that my audience is very prevalent is, number one, they're being targeted by crooks who are impersonating vendors. They figure out who this company is doing business with, and then they send a please change my bank account number to the accounts payable person, and unless they verify it, they end up sending money to crooks. And I can't tell you how many stories I've heard from people about this.
No, it's unfortunately, it is the number one fraud happening across America and throughout the world. The FBI is starting to track these numbers for the past several years. There's been about 20,000 instances in the U.S. last year, in the last several years. It's on the rise. These are reported numbers. So I think it's about triple these amounts, but 20,000 reported for about $2 billion in losses last year. That's what the FBI is reporting. Again, I think it's probably double or triple that.
And that's what they know about. A lot of times companies are too embarrassed to.
Won't report it. So I think these are wildly unreported. Another scary number is from the year 2016 to 2019. The FBI reports that worldwide, now this is worldwide, that there's been $26 billion in losses.
Oh, God.
So it's a humongous amount. And I've worked fraud all my career with the FBI and now in the private sector, and I've never seen anything like this, just one type of fraud. And they're getting better. So even the people that know about this fraud, they're still victimized because the techniques are getting better.
Yeah.
Ransomware, we're not talking about ransomware, but ransomware is kind of like a related type cyber fraud. And it's estimated last year that about $30 million in the U.S. That was, again, reported. I think it's people don't report ransomware for a variety of reasons. Just to put it in context, we're talking about billions in losses with the BEC compromise, email compromise. But ransomware, we're talking 30 to 50 million. So it's sniffling more.
Yeah. And we're also talking about, for my people, unfortunately, several of them have lost their jobs because they've changed the bank account numbers without doing the required verification. But
yes,
let me not start right about that. Okay. You've already started to share some statistics with us, but could you perhaps share a real life case story about how a particular fraud was perpetrated, how much was taken, and most importantly, which I like to get some value out of these stories, how did the company find out about it? How did they figure out what was going on?
Yeah, you know, the most common scenario is one you've already referenced, and that is dealing with vendors. Most of my examples are Atlanta, Georgia, Southeast centric, because that's where I'm dealing with business. Mm-hmm. Still talking with FBI colleagues, and they're telling me about their cases that have already been prosecuted. But, you know, just one common one, just because this is very typical, it's an agricultural business that they needed a product from China, some packaging products that they get from China. And they're dealing with a vendor, fraudster contacting, they thought it was the vendor, told them to change the routing number, which they did. And then they paid the funds to the fraudster. The way that was uncovered is then when the legitimate vendor still hasn't been paid, they're actually calling, which is unusual. You know, why haven't we been paid? And then they figure it out. A little bit on prevention here. I'll scatter some techniques, some tips. Mm-hmm. If you figure out that you're a victim, if you figure it out within 24 hours, there's a good chance of getting your money back.
Mm-hmm.
24 to 72 hours, maybe. And after 72 hours, probably never. The FBI is very attuned to this. And the FBI has another unit called the IC3, the Internet Crime Complaint Center, which does a good job of tracking these. Mm-hmm. And they're working with FinCEN. This is not well reported. They're working with FinCEN. So if you're a victim and you figure it out timely, which often unfortunately doesn't happen, but contact your bank, contact the local FBI field office, and contact IC3, and be persistent with everybody, because it's about the only chance you'll get your monies back.
Right, right. I always tell people this is time is of the essence, and this is not the time to spend 2 or 3 days doing your research, trying to make sure it's a fraud before you call the bank, unfortunately.
You know, usually they're running around with their hair on fire if the dollar amounts are high, and many times they are. So they'll have every incentive in the world to make these calls and just be persistent, because you may get a hold of somebody at the bank or the FBI, unfortunately, that's not attuned to the issue. You need to make sure you're in with the right stakeholder, because if you are, everybody's communicating. The banks knows that this is a problem. The FBI knows this is a problem. FinCEN does. What you want to have happen is the recipient bank of the funds, security department called and tell them to flag those funds and don't disperse them. That's what you want to happen.
And that has to happen quickly, because yes. The crook is going to move the money out the first legal opportunity.
Right.
Yeah. So, Vic, I see that you have a book out. Just want to take a moment to talk about it. I have to tell you, I love the title, The Honest Truth About Fraud. So can you tell us not only a little bit about the book, but, you know, we both already alluded to the fact that you used to work for the FBI. Can you tell us also a little bit about your background? So your background and the book, and then what you do now.
Sure. Well, I'm an attorney and CPA, and I've worked with the FBI for 25 years. Most of the time in the Houston division, and played a leadership roles in both Enron and WorldCom, which were very big cases, which I appreciated further since then, resulted in the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley. So those were very big cases, and I'm glad to be affiliated with them. But most of my time has been in fraud-related type work, white-collar fraud. I've also been general counsel with the FBI on 2 different occasions, so I've played as an attorney with the FBI. So now in the private sector, I kind of do what I did with the FBI, forensic accounting, internal investigations, fraud mitigation consulting, all wrapped around the issue of fraud. And then I also teach at forensic accounting as an adjunct professor at Georgia State University.
Okay.
The purpose of writing the book was when I do fraud workshops, which I enjoy doing, interacting with professionals. It's kind of a take-home material that covers some of the material in the classroom. And then I also use it at Georgia State University. So it's about a 400-page plus treatise of everything I know about fraud. And it can be used as a reference guide, so you can flip to any chapter about the particular fraud. There's a section there on the business email compromise, for example, but all the other types of fraud as well, financial statement fraud, corruption. So it's kind of a reference manual, and I use it in the classroom. That's the impetus for it.
Okay, and for everybody who's listening, there's a link down in the show notes so that you can order this directly, and I think that it will also take folks to your website.
Yes.
So they're interested in interacting with you more, they will be able to get in touch with you that way. All right. Before we continue, I'd like to invite everyone who's listening to subscribe. And if you're watching on YouTube, please ring the bell next to your subscribe button. That way you'll be notified when we post new AP content, which we do 2 or 3 times a week. Now, back to you, Vic. Do you have another story to share with us? I love stories.
Okay. Unfortunately, this particular fraud, there's just too many stories to tell.
I know.
And the dollar amounts, which I find staggering, many frauds are, you know, couple $1,000, $5,000, $10,000. These can be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'll give you an example here in a second. But another type of fraud is in the real estate industry, because it's one-time purchases. Buyers, you know, they don't do this regularly.
Right.
The fraudster gets in the title company or attorney or some intermediary and causes people to in real estate closings, to buyer to reroute the funds and not make it. So those are high-dollar transactions. They're And that's one industry that's hit by this. Another one comes to mind recently, I've just learned of and consulted on. And this was a windows covering manufacturer, and they buy cloth from other vendors in the US. So this is US to US vendors and sellers. And they somehow, probably through social engineering, the fraudster got in the email chain and then started sending fraudulent invoices, which were paid. Now, in this case, a lot of these times, if you're very astute and you're looking at where's the money going. So if you're told to change the wiring instructions, do some due diligence and see where's that bank. Now, in my first example, you're dealing business with China. So you would expect it to be maybe a Hong Kong or Chinese bank. That wouldn't be a red flag. But in this case, the routing number was changed to Hong Kong. So that was a red flag. And in fact, most of these cases, I mean, there's thousands of these cases, so there's different ways to commit the fraud. But a general commonality is that the funds go from the U.S. to Hong Kong, to China, then over to Ukraine or some former Russian republic. That's just one common scenario, or sometimes Nigeria. In this case with the window coverings, it went to a U.S. bank. But I want to introduce another concept that's part of the frauds, these sophisticated fraudsters, and that is a money mule. So they need to get the funds. They don't want to get it to their bank because that'll be a red flag. So they will do another scam known as the romance fraud. They will do online relationships, and unfortunately, it's usually female victims.
Yeah, it is.
In ages 50 to 70, that's just a common theme there as well.
I know.
But they will tell them through this romance scheme that I'm involved in a business, can I use your bank account? And I'm going to wire funds to you. So it sounds legitimate, and they see the funds come in, it all makes sense. And then with further instructions to go then from the romance victim to a Hong Kong bank, which is what happened in this case.
So I know when these email compromise frauds first started, they were actually recruiting online for supposedly legitimate jobs.
Yeah.
Was you had to use your own bank account number, which, you know, to me, that would have been a red flag.
That's too. Just like the romance, same thing. It's enabled, you're defrauding somebody. They think it's a romance. You could think it's an employer. It's the same thing. You think it's something that it's not.
Yeah.
In order to get access to your bank.
That's really all that they, yeah. Okay. All righty. So can you perhaps share some of the FBI's thinking on this issue? Because as you've said, BEC fraud is becoming more popular and we really, really need to protect against it.
In my time with the FBI, I think they never did a good enough job trying to prevent fraud. And in some extent, that's not their role, is to investigate. But after 9/11, the FBI was supposed to change their mentality, and especially as it comes to terrorism, is we have to be right every time one mishap and you have an eye. That was supposed to transcend into the white collar program. And I think still the FBI could do a better job. I do see, though, with the BEC compromise, I go to lots of conferences, either I'm speaking or I'm attending. And generally, they want somebody from the FBI to speak because they're free and they always have great stories. I know I used to present. I used to be the one telling the stories. But I think they're doing a pretty good job on this. They're getting the word out. You can go to their webpage and they have a lot of analytical products. They're giving you the stats and the number of victims. They're telling you how it's done. They're on the tip edge of the spear on these frauds. So I think they're trying to prevent it. They're getting the word out at conferences, doing this type of a webinar where they're, you know, getting the word out. So I think that's the mindset. They're aggressively prosecuting. These mules are intermediaries. Sometimes they're viewed as the victim. Sometimes they're viewed as the perpetrator. Most of the time they know what's going on, I think. After a while, they're making a lot of money themselves. So I think if you more vigorously prosecuted them, maybe it might stop it. But I think that's where the mindset is get the word out. What's the FBI?
Most of the perpetrators, though, aren't they in another country?
Yes, Nigeria or former Russian republics or Russia itself.
That makes prosecution next to impossible, never mind difficult.
Next to impossible to trace the money to them. And if you do, getting them extradited and prosecuted, it's not been very successful today.
Yeah, okay. Okay. So can you share any practical tips on how to avoid falling for one of these crooks? I mean, it's easy when you and I are talking. I mean, it sounds pretty easy, but I guess in reality, it's not.
Right. So let me give you one other scenario, which is the cutting edge of the state of the art on this fraud, which makes it very hard to prevent against. The bad actors, there's a couple ways they can attack the victim. One is, it's almost like spam. They just send out lots and lots of emails, hundreds of thousands probably. And it only takes one for somebody to act. So if those are easy to prevent against, the fraudsters are just relying on lots and lots of people. So that's one way is, and it's usually the easiest to detect. These unsolicited emails, hey, pay this invoice, your tax bill or electric company or whatever. So that's the easiest, it's the most common and easiest to protect against. Then there's a second category, which is more sophisticated, where they're targeting the CEO and they're doing lots of homework through social engineering.
Right.
They're looking at the web pages of the company, Facebook, LinkedIn, so that they can target their emails and they'll make a lot of sense when they come in.
Yep.
But even with that, they're going to have to do it through one of a couple different ways. They're going to send an email that looks like maybe it's from the CEO. but spell the name slightly different, change an L to a 1, you know, spoof the email chains. So you need to look at that. That's one way. They may also register a lookalike domain, and domains can be rented for 30 days for free, and you can have a lookalike domain. So
again, 10 bucks.
Yeah, or free. 10 bucks for free is nothing compared to the money we're talking right about here. So you, the changes in the domain by adding another word or Inc. or LLC, just slightly changing it, you may not pick up on it. And there's also companies that do spoofing as a service. So just like with ransomware, you don't have to know how to do a ransomware attack. Somebody's already developed the tools. You can just go out and buy them. Same thing with the BEC compromise. They have spoofing as a service. Great. So there's, again, somewhat preventable, but that's more targeted and sophisticated. And then the third is very difficult to protect against. And that is the bad actor has compromised the email system, either through malware, or if it's a really good attack, they're in the system as the system administrator and they have complete access to all the emails. Oof. So now they can read the email chains between the CEO and the CFO and the accounts payable. They can see all this moving. And all they have to do is insert one email at the right time. The CEO says, you know, we want to make this asset purchase, real estate closing, merger, high dollar transaction. Everybody sees that this is happening. Now the bad actor only has to slip one thing in there and says, by the way, the buyer or the seller wants you to route the funds, the $2 million to this account. And it would make total sense because the emails are right. In fact, they're 100% right. Somebody's accessed the system. People are talking in the office verbally. They're in their cubicles. Mm-hmm. The emails are flowing. Everything makes perfect sense. That one's scary and very difficult to protect against.
And it's a lot of money.
And it's a lot of money that they've invested that much effort, the bad actors have, into infiltrating the system can be high dollars.
Yep.
So I guess knowing the state of the art and knowing the ways that they can commit the fraud then helps you to protect your company. And I think the best way is through, we hate to do this, but it's really training. So taking the time, everybody, all hands on deck, you know, listen up, and then just go through what kind of this podcast.
Yep.
This podcast would be a great training tool.
Yep.
This is what's happening. This is how you can stop it. And it's just awareness. Slow down. But my best advice is you just have a policy. And again, I think maybe the employee should be fired if they don't follow the policy because they're causing losses to the company. But the policy is anytime you change a vendor or an ACH number, it takes two authorities. That causes two people to talk, two people to look over it. And if you know that you have to get approval from somebody else, you will think it through. You will look at all these telltale signs, and that it just causes you to slow the process down, think about it. And I think that's probably the best way to prevent this.
I also tell people, not so much with the real estate scheme, because that's a little bit more difficult, but accounts payable, if you get one of these change of bank account requests, you pick up the phone and you call, and you don't use any number that's in the email. I had a controller call me up one day and he said, you know, you keep recommending that people verify these changes. It's a lot of work. And it is a lot of work.
Yes.
You know, you don't verify one and $2 million goes to the wrong person. Well, you could have hired, I don't know, 20 or 30 people.
Right, exactly. No, you're precisely right.
Yeah. So it's unfortunate. All right. In a related manner, not quite BEC fraud, I'm a little bit concerned that under the Biden administration, and not concerned in a bad way because I think it's something bad that he's doing, it's actually probably something good, but that under the Biden administration, there'll be an increase in FCPA enforcements, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act enforcements, and I don't think companies are paying enough attention. And a lot of times when I mention it to the accounting people or the accounts payable people, they're like, why are you talking to us about this? We don't bribe foreign government officials. But I like to say, you're the last set of eyes to see the money before it goes out the door. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Do you think there are going to be increased enforcements?
Yeah, I think so. I know a lot about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act because I was a public corruption supervisor in Houston in the 1990s.
Okay.
And at that time, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was not aggressively enforced. And we started doing it in Houston, and of all places, it would be Houston because there's a lot of oil companies there that are doing business internationally.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they were, it was just common to pay bribes because that's the way business was done. And I have to admit, when I first started, I was responsible for these prosecutions. I did have to think twice, is this in the best interest of the U.S.? And I can see the benefit of 20 plus years now. Yes, it helps the world, stops corruption and right. foreign country. So there's lots of good reasons for it. But I also understand the hesitancy because first, it made it anti-competitive for the U.S.
Right.
With that said, and I don't want to jump too far into politics, Trump did come on and say that he thought it was a horrific law and it should be lawful for U.S. companies to bribe foreign officials. I mean, he said that, he quoted. And so you would think if that was his philosophy, maybe the administration would have followed that. If you just look at the numbers, looking from pre-Obama to Obama to Trump and to now the Biden, there was a slowdown, and the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is enforced by the SEC and DOJ. SEC civilly, DOJ criminally. There was, the numbers are showing it, relaxed enforcement in the last 4 years. Now, ironically, the penalties and fines were higher, but those are lagging indicators because those cases were started before the Trump administration, then settled during Trump. The numbers do show that they did decline in terms of number of new investigations, which is probably the real indicator. With all that said, I think you're right. I think it will go back to greater enforcement. I think Biden's on the record of saying that. You'll probably see more actions by the SEC and DOJ for both civil and criminal prosecutions and enforcement actions.
Okay, so we've got to up our game there too. All righty. Well, I could sit here and talk to you for hours, but I'm sure you have better things to do. So I would just like to ask you in closing, do you have one last minute piece of advice for our audience?
You know, I've spent most of my time with the FBI and the private sector working fraud and white collar crime. And the sad truth is almost all these are preventable, but it's taken the time for awareness. So Mary, I'm glad what you do through your podcast and otherwise. I've looked at over the last 30 years, just the different types of fraud that occurred. And it may have been insider trading in the 70s, and it could have been Ponzi schemes that we saw a lot of in the 90s. But now where we are is BEC, or ransomware as well. So it's just awareness. Hopefully we'll get a handle on these types of frauds and there'll be some new emerging frauds.
Right.
But if through education and awareness, most of these frauds are preventable.
Right. And I think that you hit on the key, education and awareness. And in some ways, we all help each other by as soon as we learn about them, if we share word about it, because sometimes just knowing about it is all you need to protect yourself, but you have to know. Okay. If you haven't already taken AP Now's Can You Spot This Phony email address quiz, you can access it on YouTube. You might also want to listen to episode 110 on avoiding duplicate payments, since they also sometimes lead to fraud. If you're watching on YouTube, a link will appear to the left. Good luck, everyone, and thanks, Vic.
All right. Thank you.